Welcome to Taking Responsibility for Torah. This is a recreation of Shir number 7 in the series on ransoming captives at any price? Owing to my failure to record the actual 7th Shir. So probably we'll have fewer interesting tangents, but a more compact and hopefully a clearer explanation of the sources. When we left, we had just finished the Maharam Lublin, who stated that no posek ever said that in practice we should redeem captives above their value. Although in the specific case he dealt with, it wasn't clear to him what the best policy was, that there were risks to the entire community, both in redeeming and not redeeming the captive. So I thought the end of the tshuva was inconclusive, and although we'll see, other people seem to have read it as having conclusions. But it was really puzzling because there is an explicit Tosfos on in Gittin that says Nunches, that says that in fact we redeem captives above their value when their lives are in danger, which Maharam Lublin explicitly denies. So the Rav Avadia begins by noting that fact, and he quotes the Sefer Beit Hillel. On your day, Reish Nun Bet, Sivkatan Bet, who writes, Shamati b'shem Marin Harav Shmuel Kednuber, Baltiv Her Shmuel, Shamar, Shin Elam, Ine Marami Lublin, Mashakasva Tosfos, Gitnan Chasm Aleph, Jimirish Sakanat Nefashel Padima So Yosri Mefedemav. Now, the Marami Lublin just missed the Tosfot. That's really strange. I don't know that we'll have any explanation for why the Maram, well, I think we may have one. You'll see if you find it plausible, of why the Maram ignored that Tosfot. But he must have had another way of reading it. It can't be that he just missed it. That seems highly unlikely. It's an easy Tosfot to find. But Hill adds, "V'hosif sh'afal pi sheyesh lidchot rayata Tosfot midin hamocher atzmo she'afshar b'stam shavui yesh lachush yoter delegruvu v'leisu." So this, I think, is an important point. Tosfos, or at least one piece of Tosfos, is evidence for the idea that we in fact redeem captives at more than their value, despite the Mishnah, when their lives are in danger. Is a story where somebody sells himself to the Luda'i, and the Gemara says that Rav Ami would have redeemed him if he had not been convinced by his colleagues that the person for specific reasons had not earned redemption. But the implication is that even though the person sold themselves, because they sold themselves to the Luda'i where their lives were in danger, he would have redeemed him. And why would you do that if normally we don't redeem people who sell themselves? That's the rule, right? We redeem their children, but not them, because we're afraid of the burden that they impose on, that will impose on the community, or to punish them for the burden they impose on the community. So the Beis Hillel says you can reject Tosfos Araya by saying, but in a case where somebody sells themselves to Luda'i, you're not putting the community at risk of outsiders coming and capturing more people. It's all an internal problem, which you can resolve, in a sense, by punishing members of your community for selling themselves if it turns out that that becomes necessary. Whereas the normal case of Pidyon Shvuyim is worried about outsiders, and so if you create an incentive for outsiders by overpaying, then you're putting the whole community at risk because you can't protect yourself against outsiders, and it will take quite some time before the outsiders learn that that they're not going to get anything because you're going to refuse to redeem captives above their values. So if the concern is that we're afraid of incentivizing the capture of Jews, so that doesn't apply if a person sells themselves, and therefore you can reject Tosfos as Raya. So that's a good reason to reject Tosfos. It's not a good reason to say that no Posek ever said it. So now the Beit Hillel has said two things, right? A, he said that the Maharam Lublin, or a tradition, the Maharam Lublin missed that Tosfot, which I'm suggesting is hard to accept. Secondly, he's giving a reason why you might reject Tosfos as proof, which is a very good point. But now he says, So the Beit Hillel believes that even though Tosfos's proof is rejectable, the outcome is correct against the Maharam Lublin. Why? Shari kosav Rambam shemalim einav mipidyon shvuyim, areza over alo sametz levavcha, velo sikposidcha, ve'alo ta'amor al dam re'echa, that presumably is only if they're captured for slavery. Right. So the Beit Hillel says that Tosas is right, not for Tosas's reason, but the overall proof is that we paskin, you have to give all your money to avoid violating a lotaseh, and you have to give all your money to avoid violating a lotaseh, and the right, and Pinyon Shroim involves a lotaseh, as the Rambam writes, then you have to give all your money to avoid failing to fulfill Pinyon Shroim, because that is a violation of a lotaseh. So I'm going to point out up front that this is a risky argument, and we'll play that out throughout the shir. Because why is Pinyon Shroim special? Pinyon Shroim is special not because it involves the violation of multiple lotaseis. That seems odd. That seems odd in principle. There's supposed to be something terrible about Pinyon Shroim, reducing Pinyon Shroim to the level where you say, well, the reason you have to give all your money for Pinyon, the reason you should have to give all your money for Pinyon Shroim is because it's just a regular case of Pikuach Nefesh, and really, Pikuach Nefesh is just a regular case of a lotaseh, really reduces the importance of Pinyon Shroim. Just like a lotaseh, now what happens if you have to choose between redeeming captives and avoiding violating Shatnez? I don't know, right? It's just, you have to give all your money for each, and if you, maybe we just give your money to whichever lotaseh comes up first. It's a very odd argument. And really, it points up the fact that the priority of Pinyon Shvuyim, to begin with, right, we pointed out in the first sugya, is a little bit odd. First of all, give Pinyon Shvuyim priority according to the Gemara because it involves everything else, and now we're claiming that even though one of the things it involves is death, but it's not really death until the captives are threatened, that's issue number one. And if we just reduce the importance of Pinyon Shvuyim to specific halachic categories, so then there's really nothing special about it at all. So it's a risky rhetorical strategy to reduce it to specific halachic categories, and reduce it to a generic halachic category, like not violating a lotaseh, so Pinyon Shroim is nothing special at all. But the Rav Avadia points out that many other achronim point out that Behil is implausible in a different way. He says that the reason that we have to redeem captives whose lives are threatened at more than their value is because of these lotaseh. But the whole point of this sugya is that we assumed that you have to redeem captives above their value, and then we made gzeira that you can't, or that you shouldn't. But let's take the Ravadi assumption all the way through that you can't. So we understood that you had a chiyuv, but we're telling you not to fulfill it. So telling us that you have a chiyuv, a generic chiyuv, because of a lotaseh, okay, but that's what the rabbis told you not to do it. So the Behil's argument is, right, is astounding, right? The Ravadi says, l'chora barav tmuhim. Right, his words are astounding because he's bringing proof from the Rambam, but the Rambam says, that's the way Rav Avadia phrases the question, the Rambam says that all Pinyon Shvuyim, even when not related to, not involving a direct threat of death, all involve these lotaseis, so then all Pinyon Shvuyim, you spend all your money, and yet there's a rabbinic decree against it. So where do you get the idea that the rabbinic decree falls away when there's an direct threat to the captives? The Rambam said that the lo talmud dam reyecha applies even if there is no direct threat, if you understand there to be a distinction between the two cases. And if you don't understand there to be a distinction between the case of threat and not threat, so then we have an explicit decree anyway that applies to all cases. So Rav Avadia says something in explaining the Beit Hillel that is really just astounding. So the tzarech lomar b'kavanato, ki v'stam shavui, yesh kach b'yad chachmim la'kor advar Torah b'shev v'altase, Mishum takanat olam ki hechid v'ligur v'v'leisu. Astam shavoy, again, we're going to read the distinction of the Meiri, as we'll see in a moment, right? We saw in previous year, the Meiri makes this distinction between regular captives and captives whose lives are directly threatened. So we're going to read that into the Rambam. And now we're going to claim, the Rambam thinks that when it comes to a regular captive, there is the Chachamim have the capacity to tell you not to fulfill your chiyav and there, or to act, to stand by and violate these lotases. But what happens in a case where the lives are directly threatened? So Rav Avadia can't claim that the rabbis have no authority to be mitaken in that case, or at least he's unwilling to claim it. I think that would have been the better argument to construct if you can construct it, that sometimes the rabbis even tell you not to fulfill a chiyuv of life saving. Rav Avadia is unwilling to say that. What he says instead is that there is no explicit evidence as to which way the rabbinic decree goes, And maybe there's even a little bit of evidence contrary because of the story of Rabbi Yeshua redeeming the child in Rome, even though, as we pointed out, it's really, really hard to accept that that child was the only captive, Jewish captive in Rome whose life was threatened. So in such a case where you can't prove this is a rabbinic decree, Chazar Adin could kechol mitzvot lo tase, shechayev liten kol mamano, kedei shli yavor b'yisur lo tase, ukimoshi chilei kamiri, bein stam shovoy le shovoy omei b'sakana mamash. Right, so Ravadia says, and again, this is, in my mind, this is utterly astounding. He says that the argument that is being made by the Beit Hillel is that it's a suffix, essentially, whether the rabbis were metakein, that you can't, that you shouldn't redeem captives whose lives are in direct threat above their value. And since this is a suffix, the chiyuv stays in place and the rabbinic prohibition against doing so goes away, maybe because of some kind of grounds of suffix deraisa l'chumra one way and suffix derabanan l'kula the other way. That's really an astounding argument because it's not really a suffix. There's a default. The default is it says, ain't ponen hashrim yosu michle demayim. You constructed a question, but you could, by the same token, you could construct the question whether the rabbis told you to redeem captives who are left-handed. Right? The Mishnah is explicit. Don't redeem captives above their face value. It's only the, right? So you have a tosfot, you have a meiri. Either tosfot and meiri are right, or tosfot and meiri are not right. The Ramban had, you know, a good argument that the tosfot is wrong. Meiri's response, as we've pointed out, is weak, and even if you accept Meiri's response, it has the effect of undermining the significance of Pinyon Shvuyim generally. It just turns into a regular case, I guess, of Pikuach Nefesh, and even then you could have arguments for the community. Really, really strange argument to claim that that because it's a suffix whether the decree of being put a Yosher Mitzvei Demeim applies to captives' lives as threatened, therefore we revert me suffix to the notion that there is a chiyuv. Very, very strange. I want to point out in this context, though, that you should recognize that the distinction between Yosher Mitzvei Demeim and Chiyuv Demeim is not really intrinsic to the chiyuv of redeeming captives, because why would we think that the mitzvah of redeeming captives is limited financially on how much the captives are worth? Really, the chiyuv should always be framed in terms of what the public can bear. Like any mitzvah, right, the chiyuv is not what the object is worth, but what you can afford to spend for it. Because if it turns out that Jews are actually worth more on the open market than non-Jews, so then why would the mitzvah not be to pay what the going rate for Jews is? So the whole thing is a decree, right? The notion that we limit it to the market price is not a reduction of some kind of super chiyuv. It's the creation of a new boundary for public policy reasons. Okay, but back to where we are. The Beit Hillel's argument to explain why we should paskin like Tosfot, even though Tosfot's own evidence is insufficient. So the Hill's own argument is incomprehensible, essentially, because he says that it's because it's a regular chiyuv lo tase, but the whole point is that it is a decree against that chiyuv lo tase. And Ravadia's attempt to reconstruct that argument by saying that it's a suffix, it seems to me, has no basis whatever in the text and is a very strange argument. It is, though, I think it's useful to point out, right? It's a very, in halachic debate, like any other debate, one of the most important tactics you can use is just to reverse the burden of proof. So Rav Avadia reverses the burden of proof here and says, you have to prove to me that the gzera goes as far as cases where there is a threat to the captives, but I don't accept his notion that Amos Mecherel of Araya goes in that way here. It seems pashut to me that the whole point of the Mishnah is that they made the decree even knowing that that might, in some cases, risk some captives' lives. And that's Pashup Shat in the Rambam, and in everyone except that Teres HaTosfot. So this is not, at best, this is a way of salvaging the Tosfot, not a proof for the Tosfot. Okay, but that, and to note even that, and again, the Beit Hillel doesn't even make this argument. This is Rav Avadia's attempt to make sense of the Beit Hillel's argument. I would have explained a bit on different grounds, the grounds of a limitation of Yesh Koach Biyad Chachamim, that he has some kind of argument which we'd have to construct, which Rav Avadia doesn't, for saying that the authority of the Chachamim does not extend to the cases where someone's life is in danger. They can't stop you from saving somebody's life is in danger. or they thought that no one would listen anyway, in the same way that we suggested that they could not decree that you can't redeem yourself at above market value, because and maybe that even extends to your wife, because people just wouldn't listen. But this is what Ravadia says. Ravadia says that that's the grounds of the Beis Hillel, and he's very happy with this. Right, he says, I saw the Shari Dei, the Beit Avram, both attacked the Beit Hillel. Okay, but then he raises a tangent issue. The Shari Dei and the Rav Ben Avram all attacked Beit Hillel on a second ground. Beit Hillel says that the reason that you have to be poded shvuyim in danger of death yosem echlei demayim is because it's like any lotase. So he says, but there's an open question about whether in fact there is a chiyuv to spend all your money to avoid violating a lo ta'aseh, the shev ve'al ta'aseh. So the Rush quotes the Ravid, who says that the chiyuv to spend all your money only applies, doesn't apply to buying an extra, because shelo amar elu mitzvah ta'aseh, the shev ve'al ta'aseh, alva mitzvah lo ta'aseh afil kol mamono, right? So it's only, sorry, the other way around. It's only for mitzvah to say that you don't have to spend your money, but for a lot to say you have to spend all your money. But he frames it as lo amar el mitzvah asay b'shev al tase. So the question is, which is the key distinction? Is it whether it's active or passive, or is it whether it's classified as an asay or classified as a lot to say? And I point out also that the same physical action can be defined as legally active or legally inactive. Continuing to wear a garment is active in terms of the mitzvah of lotaseh of shatnez. You're wearing shatnez every moment that you keep it on, but it's a shev al tasa in terms of wearing a four-cornered garment without tzitzit, because you are failing to put tzitzit on the four-cornered garment you are wearing. Right? So nothing changes, right? Person at time A is wearing the garment, person at time B is wearing the garment, but in terms of the mitzvah of the Isra of Shatnez, you've been actively kumasei, and in terms of the mitzvah of tzitzis, you have been passively shev al tase. So three axes, whether it's defined formally as an asay or a lo tasei, whether in fact you have been active or passive, or whether legally you have been defined as being active or as being passive. And there are confounding categories like Isur asay. We spent time on this summer on Rav Hirschel Schechter's argument about whether an Isur Asay is an Asay or a Lav, right? I think, if I recall correctly, he argued that it's a Lav for these purposes, right? But there are many confounding categories you can have that way. But for our purposes, the argument that they make is that the ordinarily, right, the rabbi isn't focused on the legal axis of asay versus lo tasay. He's focused on the practical axis of active versus inactive, and therefore the rabbi would agree you don't have to spend all your money to avoid passively violating a lo tasay. So a lo tasay, which is a double negative, right, do not save your friend, right, lo ta'amaro dam le'acha. The rabbi would agree that functions, the double negative is a positive, and that functions like an assay, as you only have to spend a fifth of your money in order to avoid violating a lo ta'aseh inactively, such as failing to redeem a captive. And we could talk about whether a fifth is a literal meaning. Also, it seems clear here that we're treating a fifth as some kind of measure of its impact on your economic standing, and not that we actually conduct an audit. But that's tangential to our purposes. If we were to claim, right, the assumption right now is that if you have to redeem captives above their value, that means there's no limit, and that would mean even if it were half your assets and not just 20%. Okay, so the Shari Dei and the Ben Avram attacked Beit Hillel, and they say that your strategy of making Pidyon Shvuim, who are threatened with death, in ordinary Lota say will fail because the Lota say that you're constructing is a Lota say that is violated passively through inaction as opposed to action. So Rav Avadia says, look, even though the Chabos Yair says the same thing, the Chabos Yair says that you don't have to spend all your money to avoid violating a lo tase b'shev ba'al ta'aseh. Now it should be free of the Chabad Yair should not be balanced by the framing of Rav Avadya's understanding of the writer that it depends on action versus inaction, and whether it depends on how the lo tase is framed. Is it a lo tase that can be violated actively, or that by definition is only violated passively? The Chabad Yair seems to think it matters very much on what you are doing, not the formulation of the lo tase. But he's also talking about a case, and he's talking about a case where how much money do you have to spend to avoid having someone remain unburied? And so you could read it in the same language. But the Chabad Yair also says that in such a case, there's the chiyuv. He certainly says this, right? That the chiyuv to spend all your money to avoid a lo tase doesn't apply in every situation to all lo tase, so maybe it also doesn't apply here. But Rav Avadya says against that, there's a Shur Rivash, and the Shur Rivash says that that we reject that in Yomar Baldin Mitzvah Lo Taseh Shein Damase Arehi Be'inyan Zeh Mitzvah Taseh Yivan Sheino Avir Be'edayim Alav Haraya. He says if you want to argue that you don't have to spend the money, so you have the proof. So he doesn't really settle the issue. He creates the burden of proof issue. We could decide how the burden of proof issue plays out here, and certainly the rabbis, the rabbanim, could reverse the argument of proof. But the argument Rav Avadya makes is that the Rivash is against the Chabad Yair. Again, I'm not at all convinced, and it could be that the Rivash is talking about a specific issue in terms of Shavuos, and again, he's only dealing with burden of proof. So there are all sorts of ways, I think, in which you could reject the Rav Avadya's Raya, but he claims it's the Rivash against the Chabad Yair, and he quotes the Beit HaShoeva, who says that the Divrei Chabad Yair was a and the Ramah quotes the position that you're not chayev. The Sham Siyam the Divrei Rivash, right? You are chayev. The Sham Siyam the Divrei Rivash, and the Ramah himself quotes the Rivash. So that, whatever. Okay. The Ramah does quote the Rivash, but again, I think that these are rayos listor. They're counterproofs. When you know that a great figure must have known of this, and he doesn't. Think it's relevant, you have to understand why it's relevant, not reject him because he failed to quote something that he obviously knew about. Fine. So, but that's where Rav Avadya is. He thinks that the Rivash is a sufficient disproof of the Chabad Yair to redeem the Beit Hillel and say that the ground for Pinyan Shvuyim, that you have to spend money on Pinyan Shvuyim, is that you have to spend all your money rather than avoid any lo taseh. Many layers of weakness in this argument. He then quotes the Chassam Sofer, which is important. The Chassam Sofer Katav, the Ledivri HaSoferim, the Mitzvah lo taseh af b'shev al taseh tzareh levaz beis kol mamono. According to those people who hold like that understanding of the Rivash, the Shea Masha Kassam Rambam, the Pinyan Shvuyim Mnei Atzmo Vera lo taseh lo tamo dam recha. So that's a problem with the Rambam, who says that Pinyan Shvuyim involves a lo taseh. Okay, again, I don't know why the Rambam can't say there's a lo taseh, but the rabbi stopped him from doing it. Someone has to explain to me why their argument is implausible. So I mean, can't, right? But the Chassam Sofer asked the same question on the assumption that there has to be this limit on rabbinic power. It's frustrating that that's really probably the most, from an understanding of the nature of halacha thing, that would be the most powerful claim that the rabbis don't have the capacity to stop you from saving lives. Can't legislate against that. But everyone, if they believe it, they believe it, they think that it's sufficiently clear. I guess they don't have to state the premise. So if Sam Sofer says to resolve this problem, then really the Amra Haran to Tzareif Levaz Boz Komono Elo Biachid Aval B'tzibur Hanichak V'Yivrat Yizman Shemot Olam Yadam Kifal Yisrael Dochel Tzibur Aved Bichlal Pikuach Nefer. So the Chassam Sofer chooses to escalate in the other direction. And he says, look, we couldn't stop individuals from saving, we wouldn't say that individuals don't have a fear to spend all their money for the low tax day of saving lives. But we will say that for the community, not because there's a limit on rabbinic power, but because spending all the community money is sakanas nefashos the other way. Because an impoverished community has no capacity to protect its members or to support its members in the ways that are necessary to keep them alive. All right, so that's a really interesting distinction. And again, if Tom Silver does it by escalating in the other way, as opposed to saying there's a limit on rabbinic power. But Ravadia points out that this argument is wholly implausible, because the Gemara itself, when it's trying to establish what the rationale is for the decree, the Gemara says, well, what about Levi Bar Darga, who redeemed his daughter? And the answer is, yeah, maybe he did it against the will of the Chachamim. But if you claim that the decree was only about communities, and not about individuals, the Gemara's question doesn't get started, because the mission is only talking about community, and the Gemara is dealing with a case of individuals. So you could try and claim that Levi Bar Darga functioned as a community figure in redeeming his daughter, but there's no hint of that in the Gemara, and I haven't seen anybody say that explicitly. So that's a his answer for the Chassam Sofer. Well, Chassam Sofer is a I think intuitively a plausible argument. It is against the evidence in his and I think Rav Avadia is entirely correct that it's against the evidence, and that the Chassam Sofer had no need to escalate. He could have just said Yesh Kof Yad Chachamim. Okay, but why everybody doesn't realize that for the other argument, I don't understand as well. So it comes out that at the end of this section of the Rav Avadia, that really he just falls back on saying that the Paskim like that answer of Sosos, as explained by the Meiri, and there are good arguments against the Sosos, very, very good arguments against the Sosos. And there's even Maharam Lubun who postulates against it. He tries to deal with the Achronim who reject the Maharam Lubun, but at the end of the day, all Rav Avadia has is a Tosfos that's very strange and a Meiri that's very weak, explaining that Tosfos. But, right, we're left with it, but it's still a Tosfos against Maharam Lubun. So the next source Rav Avadia is going to quote is the Yad Eliyahu. Before I get to the Yad Eliyahu, I left out one or two things that I should throw in. One is that Rav Avadia quoted a Tanakh Tzedek who seems to read Tosfot as saying that Tosfot's two answers, one to the case of the child of Yeshua Bechani redeemed in Rome. One is he was in danger of death, and the other is he was Muflag Bechachma. It really reads them as one answer, saying that if you're in danger of death and you're a great scholar, then right, and you're potentially a great scholar, then we redeem you. Maybe that there are two answers. One answer is that even if you're a great scholar, we redeem you only if your life is threatened. And the other is we redeem you if you're a great scholar, even if your life is not in danger. Rav Avadia points out that seems to be against the Piskei Tosfot, which Paskins like both reasons. But if you read Tosfos that way originally, then you can probably read the Piskei Tosfos that way as well. But it's very hard to read Tosfos that way. Unless you want to argue that as I suggested in previous Shurim, that maybe there was some kind of editing error in Tosfos so that this reason was left independent. But as we have it written, I don't think you can read it that way. But you should be aware that seems to be a possible, it's possible that the Tzemach Tzedek read it that way. And if the Maharam Milublin read it that way, that would explain why he ignores the Tosfot. Okay, I think I can leave out the other thing. So let's go on to the Yad Eliyahu. Yad Eliyahu brings us into a whole new topic, and we're going to discuss it just very briefly now, and then we'll finish it and hopefully the whole Rav Avadia next week. The question he raises is under what circumstances are people obligated, allowed, or forbidden to take risks to save others? And essentially, what we're going to try and raise the issue is that there are situations, even if you don't accept the Chassam Sofer, that allowing the community to overspend on captives is pikuach nefesh for the community. It seems clear that in our case, releasing prisoners, especially prisoners who have already murdered, terrorist prisoners who have already murdered, imposes some degree of risk on the entire rest of the population. So we can ask the question, right, is that a good thing? Is that an acceptable thing? Is that a forbidden thing? But the Yad Eliyahu begins the his analysis in a way which I think is about as diametrically opposed to the way I would like this analysis to go as possible. So we'll have to see to what degree my position is sustainable and to what degree his position is sustainable. He says that the I don't understand the question you're asking, right? So the question you're asking is in Mechuyavet, just background, the Yad Eliyahu is of Eliyahu Rabbi Shmuel, and he is born in Lublin in Poland in 1660, according to the Bar-Ilan summary, learned in Brisk, and published his Sefer Yad Eliyahu in 1712. Okay, and he had been there, based in many in various communities, and he corresponds with various Gedolim. Bar-Ilan focuses specifically on the Chacham Tzvi, and eventually, but this is after our book, so we don't care so much, right? Goes on. Goes in Aliyah and lives in Hebron and dies in 1740. But okay, rather just get the context and decide how atypical he was for his time and place, or typical in terms of the argument he makes. So the question he's asked is, "In mechuyav adam lahachnis atzmo b'sakanat nefesho kedei lahatzil chaverot bivadai, or in a mechuyav b'zeh?" Right. So does a person have to put themselves in danger? In all right, in or in order for their in order to save their friend, in order to certainly save their friend from certain death. Okay, this is like this is an artificially constructed situation where the I call it a digital as opposed to analog switch description of the problem, where there are only two switches, safek and vadai. And so the question he's asked is, in a case where does a person have to engage in any risk to their own life in order to be in a situation where they will 100% save somebody from something which would otherwise 100% be the cause of their death. So that's not a real life situation. And we'll have to figure out right now how in the real world we would paskin these sorts of cases, where if we stuck to the digital switch model where the only things are suffix and vaday, we're going to have to move the categories of suffix and vaday. So, right, for example, we can make anything that's a rove a vaday, right? So now it's saving your friend from a 51% chance as opposed to 100% chance. And we can say that in order to rise to the level of suffix, it has to be at least a mid hamatzvah. So now we can raise the risk that you're allowed to take without triggering this issue up to 15%, say, right? The whole machlokes about what mid hamatzvah is in terms of trefus, decide how you apply it here. So we could conceivably get the gap instead of being from 1% or 0.01% to 99.99 to right to 100%. We could have the gap between the risk you're taking and the risk you're saving be reduced to 15 to 51. All right, just to point it out, then we could make the 51% apply to both sides. So it's a 51% chance of rescuing somebody from a 51% chance of death. So now we've got it down to under 26%. Again, I say I generally prefer to think about analog switches where the percentages relate to each other, but that's a conversation for a different point. So he asks the question ideally. And having asked the question in this ideal form, the digital switch form with only two states, he then, right, so is it, are you mechuyav or in mechuyav, aval kol panim rashai, midat chasidut o machmad ahavat chaviro, oh, in rashai, let's say, it's makal. And his answer, again, which is exactly the answer I would not give, is your question is not properly formulated because you didn't ask who the parties are. Now, my understanding is that my chazan, the Dhamma Didach, should some expire. Who says your blood is redder? The Gemara's explanation for why you can't murder somebody else. Dafka means that in situations of life saving, you shouldn't ask who is on one side of the equation or other. And it points out how most poskim utterly sideline the Mishnah in Horios, which has levels of precedence. The Yad Eliyahu goes in the exact opposite direction. And he says the question you should ask is what is the relative stature in Torah of the various parties? Because certainly, he quotes the Sefer Chassidim, who says that it's a mitzvah for an Am HaAretz to volunteer, right? If captors are going to, execute one prisoner randomly or in response to an offense, so it's a mitzvah for an Am HaAretz to volunteer to be executed instead of a Talmid Chacham. So he says that what matters, to answer this question, you have to know which of them is a Talmid Chacham and which of them is an Am HaAretz, because it's forbidden for a Talmid Chacham to risk themselves to Am HaAretz, but it's a mitzvah for an Am HaAretz to risk themselves for Talmid Chacham. As a reshus, if you're dealing with people who are both Talmid Chachamim, but one is a greater Talmid Chacham than the other, so the lesser Talmid Chacham is allowed to risk themselves. That's the way in which his argument is going to work. We will spend some time on that next week. Again, I am very much opposed to this model of thinking. We also have to think about whether it has any relevance for our case at all. Are we really going to ask the question, how many Talmidei Chacham are there among the hostages? How do those Talmidei Chacham relate to the Talmidei Chacham who remain in the community? And right, that seems to me just an utterly implausible way of going about it. But Ravadia does quote the Aleliyos, so we'll have to see how he uses it, and we'll pick that up next week. Thank you, as always, for listening. Next week, episode 8 of this series, I expect I hope we'll conclude our discussion of Rav Ovadia specifically, and then my expectation is there will be one or two more shiurim covering other treatments of the same issue, at least Rav Asher Weiss and the Shipnei Vanim, Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, and then we'll figure out whether we want to proceed with this topic or move on to something else. Thank you again.